I push that button, looks like we're rolling again here. Yeah. So we're back from lunch, and we talked about a number of topics, but two that I want to follow up on. One is Sybil Rock. Sybil worked for CEC and did a lot of their analysis type stuff, and probably one of the earliest women to work in the field. Tell me about Sybil. What was she like, and what kind of things was she doing? And
she was very professional. I only remember her coming to the meetings in at the Pittsburgh conference. At the Pittsburgh conference, there was a subsection of mass spectrometry that then turned into E14. But my first conference was 1952, I think.
For Pittsburgh?
For Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And I think that's right. I met her there, and she was there. Well, she might have come to the 53 conference was there. It seemed like by 54 we went to E14, went to New Orleans, 55 in San Francisco. Anyway, I only remember her from two or three conferences. I remember corresponding with her about the key sort cards and about using reference spectra that they collected at Dow, and then with people like Charlie Judson, we got together the uncertified spectral committee, and we got that going in the mid-50s.
So there was this issue of trying to compile a collection of spectra. The differentiation was that CEC was interested in, and the petroleum companies were interested in getting these, quote, certified spectra, which they could use in their quantitative and analytical work. And the uncertified spectra were just spectra of compounds that weren't necessarily needed in a quantitative sense, but to get,
that's right,
just get a record of the spectra of the compound.
Those Pittsburgh early Pittsburgh conference meetings were dominated by the petroleum chemists. They're really nice guys, and they used to tease the few of us that were organic mass spec people and did other kinds of compounds, and yet they never gave us any trouble about giving papers, and they came to our papers, and yet that wasn't their bread and butter, and they had, and it wasn't really that you shouldn't send your reference mass spectra to API, but they had some bureaucrats there that when you people would send them, they'd get it back, you don't have the proper 58-43 ratio, or what's this instrument you're running it on called a Westinghouse, and the real problem was that people had shoeboxes full of spectra that the rest of us would like to look at, and we would like to contribute ours, but nobody had the time to put it into careful format and everything. And so the thing that we easily all agreed on, I think I was the first chair of the uncertified spectral committee.
Would that have been in the mid-50s?
That was around the 55 or something like that. And we just sort of all agreed. Well, Jack Sharkey and from the Bureau of Mines in Pittsburgh, I said his name this morning.
Friedel? No, Friedel.
Gus Friedel. Gus Friedel. Jack Sharkey and Gus Friedel were a backbone of this. Other people were interested, and we all said, well, come on, everybody's got to send in. Let's all try to send in 50 spectra this year. And some of them did, and I didn't. And yet I was collecting them, and I was putting them in the collection and everything. And, of course, to make the long story even shorter, you remember that I finally had Roland Golke put our collection together,
mm-hmm.
and that's that yellow thing with the Dow Diamond
yeah.
on the back. Yeah, that's so that was years later before I fulfilled, but we that has 2,000 and API plus all the other contributions at that time were maybe 2,500, and so we nearly doubled the collection
yeah.
when we finally got it out.
So these were uncertified spectra.
And these were all uncertified. Yes, that's what it says on Dow's collection of uncertified spectra. But it actually was a very nice thing, and the people worked together on it. And I can even remember at one of those meetings, we sort of. Oh, I know. I had already started working on a paper for analytical chemistry correlating the mass spectra of alcohols.
Mm-hmm.
And to my surprise, Friedel and Sharkey had a paper on the correlating the mass spectra of alcohols at the conference.
Mm.
And so we got together and we said, well, what else you do? What else are any one of you doing? And I said, well, we're already started on aldehydes and I forgot who else was doing what. And so we decided that, well, why don't you go ahead and publish alcohols and we'll do aldehydes next. And I think we had promises from several other people and who all came through. I've forgotten, but this way, most of the people didn't write papers, but at least it said spectra in.
So, I mean, people were interested in looking at compounds other than just the hydrocarbons and seeing how they behave, the kind of spectra they would get, and the kind of fragmentation patterns that you would have.
If you want to look at, for this history talk I gave at the 50th ASMS meeting, I looked up those things and the names that were attached, and that helps my poor brain. It was 90-10 or 85-15 or something like that in favor of petroleum papers.
Yeah.
But that was fine.
So now I'd like to pick up on this, on the Boston laboratory. What happened to it after you left?
Well, of course, it went downhill very rapidly. No, it actually stayed around and was an important thing for Dow. I think that it folded up in 1988. I left in 1964, I bought 30 acres for the laboratory for $100,000, overlooking the Mass Pike
mm-hmm.
in Wayland, Massachusetts, not far from Route 128, and so. If they didn't make any money on the research, my real estate investment was a good one.
I can imagine so. So I guess it's kind of interesting. There was this period when industrial operations wanted to have these research laboratories, and they all went out
yeah.
and did this. And then in the late 80s and early 90s, they decided we don't want to do that, and they all started canning and divesting themselves of these activities. So
I didn't really find out. In fact, I guess to admit it, I wasn't too interested in finding out why they shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to get told about the patents and the successful new products
mm-hmm.
that came long ways. And I still think probably the most important thing they got out of was good people.
Yeah.
Yeah. We certainly could hire people that, and the people were perfectly happy after this 5 or 6 or 7 years we were talking about, suddenly to go home
yeah,
and tell the wife
yeah.
I can be a group leader in the XYZ lab in Michigan and I get a 20% raise
yeah.
and isn't that by that
it's
time they've got two kids and one on
yeah.
another one on the way and so whether But, gee, quite a few people in the lab actually, well, only one ended up with a Nobel Prize. Oh. In the book, there's Richard Ernst, NMR.
Yeah.
And he tells about leaving Switzerland to go work at Vera NMR. He invented 2D NMR.
Mm-hmm. This is a book by Carsten Reinhardt.
Yeah, book by Carsten Reinhardt. I interviewed him before he went there, and some years later, I introduced him. I was chair of the chemistry section of the AAAS at the national meeting, and I had a thing with people from all over. And when he got up, he said, "Yes, I've known Fred a long time. My career was really stunted when I turned down his offer to work at the Dow Chemical Company."
But I think he made a very telling comment just a minute ago. He said the thing that Dow got out of the lab was the people. And I think that today that doesn't carry any weight, people. I mean, the industrial operations today, that's, you know, people don't mean much at all. And so it's a sad commentary, but I mean, maybe I'm coloring the situation, but having worked in an industrial situation in the laboratory,
I've seen it
disappear as the yacht goes. And, I mean, we had very good people at McDonald Douglas Research Labs. They were doing very good work, and there was work that was useful to the company. But for some reason or other, the management style became totally focused on the bottom line at all costs, and whether you had a quality person working for you, you know, doing serious good science was irrelevant. That didn't matter. And so I think that, like I say, I think it's a very telling comment that what Dow got out of the Boston operation was good people.
Oh, for example, I started a Dow basic annual basic research symposium.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, I'd gotten to know people. And Dow had a Walnut Creek, California plant and one in Texas and some operations in Switzerland and so forth. And so I got the something like I and a few of my cronies chose the 40 people we thought were doing the most basic cutting-edge research and got them all out to our lab. We had this house with 9 bedrooms. Tibby put on a big party for all of these guys, and we had 2 or 3 days of papers by all of them. Oh, they thought this was the greatest thing. The Dow is really scientific.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great for all of us to learn what the rest of them were doing, and we could collaborate. And you know, it was a real great thing that these people stayed at Dow. They had contacts with companies.
Yeah.
The people you know in the company make all the difference. You can call up Joe Schmo and I need this, or I just heard this. It really makes things work.
Yes.
But these money managers, they want to show the year's profits better.
Yeah.
They can take your salary and put it in there by firing.
Yeah. No, it's a sad situation that's evolved. And, but, I mean, things change, and I guess that's the way it was. I have a friend that retired from McDonnell Douglas, and when he retired, it was probably about 15 years ago, his commentary was that he recognized, even at that time, that he had lived through like a golden age in the industrial research laboratory. When, you know, you started working, your capabilities were respected as a scientist. The work you did was respected. Whether or not it made the company money in the bottom line was not an issue. The fact that you were doing cutting-edge research and so on. And then towards the end of his career, he saw that no longer held value to the management, and so that was his kind of swan song, is that he was at least glad to have worked during what he would call a golden age of working in an industrial laboratory and, you know, being...
Well, the other thing I saw was that having good research supervision, direction, management is very difficult to get, because people that are good at that often go to academic careers, but that there's no kind of a training course in companies usually for this kind of a thing. And so often laboratory directors that's kind of totally went to seed, then immediately the whole lab went to seed. That they couldn't be interested in everything going on and enthusiastic, and if they couldn't be enthusiastic, they had to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And Melvin Calvin was a Dow consultant. You remember Melvin Calvin, Nobel Prize,
mm-hmm.
and all those things. In fact, he ended up on their board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
And he, when he came to Midland as a consultant, and he got to my lab one time, he was terrific. He, you know, what are you doing? Well, why are you doing that? Why do you do it that way? Well, doesn't that mean you could do it this way? And he didn't scold you or anything else. He just caught on to it. And I used to have him come out to our little tiny lab. I'd forgotten whether they charged $200 a day or $2 million a day.
Mm-hmm.
They paid for it back in Midland, so
mm-hmm.
I didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
But, he just lighted the fire into these guys.
Yeah.
He was interested in anything they were doing, and he could ask questions about anything. And if he asked questions and they were really doing everything almost right, well, how totally flattered they are.
Mm-hmm.
And almost always when he asked about my research, I wasn't doing everything totally right. Yeah, he was great.
That's an interesting motivation, is to have someone with that kind of reputation, interact with the bench chemist and, like you say, kind of reinforce the fact that he's doing well, which really gives him a big boost in, in his morale.
Oh, I certainly tried to copy his techniques mm-hmm. as a lab director, but if we'd only had him instead teach a course to all the lab directors and have some way of making them take it in,
mm-hmm.
Company have been better off.
So during lunch we were chatting a little bit about this gentleman John Bynum. So
John and Yvonne, what a great team.
Yeah. So you said that there was an ASTM meeting in the West Coast, and then he stopped
by San Francisco, and he stopped by at Midland to see my lab, and that was 1955, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
At least for this talk, I got out the San Francisco E14 mm-hmm. notes, and I have even made a slide out of notes he had on his first high resolution data.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, even before he came to my lab, by mail, he had tried to get me to go in with him. I can't remember just what, but by that time, the things were really set, but he still wanted me to do it because that would help the cost of his instrument, and of course I should have done it, except that the instrument would then have arrived in Midland, Michigan after I'd gone to Framingham. That was the only reason I was glad.
So he was trying to politic you into buying one of these early MS-9 type
exactly
instruments.
The same instrument he got.
Okay, so that would help the company in selling him, would cut his price down and help him cut a better deal.
But note the kind of guy he is. It wasn't that he wanted to hog the whole field.
Mm.
John was exactly the opposite kind of guy. He thought it was such a great thing, he thought we all ought to do it. And he still did all the early work and gets all the early credit,
mm-hmm.
even though he gave dummies like me a chance to share the credit.
So then you were, like you say, if you had gone ahead and bought the instrument, you would have left Midland Labs by that time and gone east. And so finally we
would have been close. Yeah.
So I just maybe do a segue for a minute into your private life. You had a pretty good sized family by that time. You had like four or five kids, is it?
Yeah, the three of them arrived in Midland and the other two arrived in Boston.
So that must have been a pretty exciting time back at home. Chris, did you have this huge home with all these bedrooms? Did you buy that?
We lived four years in another part of Wellesley in a much smaller house, and it was the fifth one arriving that really made us look for a larger house, and somehow we got this place, and it had 3 acres, and my friend that I haven't seen for some time, but that told me how many $1 billion those 3 acres are worth now.
Oh, wow, I can imagine.
but it's right in the heart of Wellesley Hills, mm-hmm. and had these marvelous huge trees, and the ash tree that some famous politician gave his first political talk under.
Oh, really?
Things like that.
So your wife had her hands full with the young
Tiffany
family.
Tiffany is absolutely terrific. She took care of everything. She still does.
Well, she takes care of you. It takes care of me.
I mean, that's a full-time job. And 5 kids.
Boy.
Yeah.
So finally, you decided to leave even the Dow Research lab that you set up in Boston in
56 to 64, I left. So I was there 8 years.
Okay, so you left in 64.
I went to Purdue in 64.
Purdue in 64. So we finally were able to get to academia. Did they come to you for the opportunity, or
yeah.
out of that world? So they wanted you.
Well,
to
the first thing is I was part of the reason for putting the lab there was to contacts with all the very fine chemistry departments locally and on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked hard at that, and I became chairman of the Northeast ACS section, and of course I interviewed at all these places. And I got to know many of the faculty. And one of the guys I got to know was Buck Rogers, Lockhart B. Rogers.
Is that ROG?
LB, his initials are LB, but everybody called him Buck
mm-hmm.
because of the obvious connotation.
This ROGERS?
Yes.
Okay.
It was like the astronaut.
Right,
the
Buck Rogers.
Buck Rogers, yeah. And he was an analytical chemist at MIT.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the time when all of the best university chemistry departments were getting rid of analytical chemistry. And so he had tenure, but I don't know all the circumstances, but anyway, Purdue made him an offer he couldn't resist, to go out there and build a great analytical department. And once he got there, then he wanted to attract me there, and I went out and turned down their first offer. But then after things got boring, and I still love to do research, and yet the administration part, I had a stack of JCS's unread on my desk like this,
mm-hmm.
and I said, it's here whether I go left or I go right. And so that's when we moved to Purdue.
So you decided to finally get into academia, and they wanted you. Now you didn't have to go around and get rejected or not hear from anybody.
Yeah. In fact, the head of the chemistry department at MIT was Art Cope,
mm-hmm.
and he had come in to make MIT department a great one, and they did a great job, but mm-hmm. he was head of department and mm-hmm. doing things, and he's the one that decided they would do mass spectrometry and got an instrument for Klaus mm-hmm. Beeman, and I talked to him about it, but I must admit it's the fact that Tibby was in an organization with his wife that probably had more to do with my knowing Art Cope.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you take what you get. So anyway, I knew Klaus early through Art Cope,
mm-hmm.
and that was great fun. I could drop into Klaus's lab when I was ever down at MIT,
So you actually interacted with him in that period. You could, like I say, you could visit him whenever you were in the neighborhood and see what he was up to.
Yeah, I would, and Klaus doesn't need help from anyone.
Oh no.
But I'm not making fun of Klaus. He did a great job, and well, Al Burlingame was one of his grad students, and of course Al was easy to talk to.
Yeah,
yeah, and he had a whole bunch of people. Spitellers were great friends of mine. Who else was in there? Walt.
How do you spell Spitaler?
S-P-I-T, Spit, E-L-L-E-R, Spitaler. Mm-hmm. And both they were both postdocs. They were both, I think, from Austria.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up at, well, I'll think of it, University of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them ended up there as professors.
And Walt, was it Walt?
Walt McMurray.
Walt McMurray,
Walt McMurray at Yale. And, well, I essentially knew all of his
early graduates.
Yeah, and Klaus was totally nice to me. He never acted like I was spying on him or something when I came into his lab. And now, don't tell Klaus this. But I think he asked me. I don't think it was Berlinghe, but I was in there one day and somebody asked me, and they hadn't had their instrument going very long, and they said, oh, we've got this funny peak that shows up in our spectrum. And I said, what mass is it? They said, 149. I know what it is.
Yes. We all know what it is.
Yeah, and you'd have known, if you'd visited his lab, you'd know what it is. Well, of course, he knew from that day on, he knew what it was. It wasn't that I made any great discovery for him.
Yeah.
But those are the kinds of things I talked to him about. His peptide stuff was absolutely terrific.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely
yeah.
terrific.
Yeah.
And his indole alkaloids, as a Dow person, I certainly wasn't going to compete with him with anything like that, heaven's sakes. So we weren't really in competition about things. And he was, I had to have people to talk to about mass spec, and I didn't have anybody. And so he was a life raft. He was wonderful.
So when you sat at the Boston lab, you didn't have any mass spec capability there.
Well, we finally, I got roll with Golke to move out from Middle. He was had unhappinesses there, and I said, well, come on out to our place. And so he got a Bendix time of flight, and we had great fun with that. One of the pictures, I think the pictures in
some pictures in Karsten's
I think with Roland up against the time of flight, and I think speaking of direct probes,
mm-hmm.
I think it's visible because mm-hmm. he built a direct probe mm-hmm. for the instrument that we in fact I got all the details of it from Jack O'Neill at
Michelle. So why don't we talk about that now, because I mean that's a method of introducing samples to the solid state that obviously has been extremely useful, but in my own quote research into the history of it, it's a little bit foggy as to exactly who's the main person who actually got that going. And so you're saying?
What my recollection?
Yeah. What is your recollection?
Well, we could look it up in the AS and the E14 things. But my recollection, it was like the 1959 ASM E14, and Jack O'Neill had put this on his 103,
mm-hmm.
and told us all about the, and he'd put very large hydrocarbons in there and gotten them. And hell, we were all excited. And Roland built it for our mass spectrometers. I mean, the implementation wasn't totally terrible,
mm-hmm.
but I went along in there about that time, maybe 1960. We could probably get the dates out of it. Remember Ivor Roland Reed?
Mm-hmm.
R.I. Mm-hmm. Roland Ivor Reed at Scotland, at not Edinburgh, but Glasgow.
Yeah, Glasgow.
University of Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
I visited him there, and he had made a direct probe that I'm not sure he might have done it independently of mm-hmm. Jack O'Neill, but it was a copper rod that he pushed through a set of O-rings, And you showed me running samples, and he had the a spot of the sample on the end of the copper rod, and they put a Bunsen burner on the other end, and he got a spectra. I said, why don't you heat it electrically? Well, what's the matter with this?
So that was a pretty expeditious way of
and
warming
so
up.
I think that's written up somewhere in the literature, and Ivor Reed has a textbook along in there that I think it's mentioned in.
Do you know what time, what year that would have been? In,
that was around 1960 or something like that. I probably can...
So people were coming to this concept in different directions, but it was also implemented in the time of flight.
Oh, another story, along in there, maybe it was 62 or something, I visited Vlada Hanus, H-A-N-U-S, in Prague, at the
what was his first name?
V-L-A-D-A, Vlada.
Vlada. Okay.
Hanus.
Okay.
And he was a great pioneer in running large organic molecules, even alkaloids.
Okay.
Alkaloids. Only the way he ran it, and he had a Russian, of course, Czechoslovakia had nothing. He had a Russian mass spectrometer, and I witnessed this in his lab. He broke vacuum, unfolded the whole ion source, put the sample inside of a little capillary that had been pulled out with a tiny capillary on the end of it, that put it back in the ion source, shoved the whole thing together, bolted it down, pumped it down, and then, of course, the ion source heated itself when you turned on the filament, and he was getting beautiful spectra. I said, how many spectra a day do you run? Well, we can run 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful spectra, and you'll find them in the literature back in the early 60s. Mm. And he didn't have a direct probe or anything.
Yeah. Well, that's one way of getting it done.
So this direct probe was that was the cutting edge. It sounds totally foolish after electrospray and MALDI and all those things. But
so what about, I thought Bendix was involved in this whole thing too. Bendix time of flight.
Bendix put one on very early.
So now their design was derived, did they do that, derive it their own, or was that taken from other work that they were aware of,
I think they got it from Jack O'Neill.
From O'Neill.
I'm pretty sure the Bendix thing came out in 60 or 61, and Roland, we had very close relations with Bendix.
Sure.
Because they were in North Detroit, and they were only an hour and a half drive from Midland. Mm-hmm. And that's when we did our first GCMS, mm-hmm. is we took Roland's GC and put it in the back seat. We drove down to Bendix.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was February 1956. And so that made it very easy because they had the instrument. February 56. Yeah, that's right. But we got the first laboratory time of flight, except that it arrived just about the time I left.
Mm-hmm.
And
to go east.
DuPont got the first two, but they got them for process control.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so Bill Wiley and
did you know Bill Wiley?
Oh yeah, okay. he was the guy I called to arrange our thing, and the guy I saw the most of after that was
Gunninger. There was a guy named Ed Gunninger and Bert Lupke
those guys, yeah.
John Damas and
what a stupid. Dan Harrington.
Oh, Harrington, yeah, sure. Yeah.
He sent me a letter that described our first experiment to Mm-hmm. Is another of my good stories how Roland pulled the wool over my eyes. Well, it took me years to figure out. Here's Roland sitting in front of the oscilloscope, and they had a slave scope that I'm watching.
Mm-hmm.
And Roland beat me every time interpreting the spectrum that came up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was years later that I woke up and I realized that Roland was the one that made up the samples, and Roland's the one that had tried to model the GC before we left. And so, hell, the bastard knew which ones were going to come out first. Damn, I got suckered.
wasn't looking at the mass spectra so much as he was knowing that each one came out in the respective order.
He was way ahead of Fred. Fred thought he was coming close to having them identified, and Roland beat me every time.
Now, when we got Roland on the grill here, he told me a story at lunch that was a little unusual about how he was able to make a demonstration with using his fingers on the time of flight. So we need to take over that again.
Oh, you want me to put that on the...
Oh, yeah, we need to get that story.
Okay. This was, I would guess, 1958 or 59, and I was at the Eastern Research Lab, and I was back for one of my... I went back every month or two to report to the management, and at the time there happened to be an open house at the spectroscopy lab for families.
Mm-hmm.
And Roland had the Bendix time of flight, and he had to do a demo for families to show what a wonderful thing it is. And so here is the oscilloscope showing the spectrum, and the spectrum had an 18 peak for water and 28 and 32 mm-hmm. for air. And Roland explains all this, and then he put his finger on there was a pump down valve near the ion source on the housing of the mass spectrometer, as I remember. Mm-hmm. He might have had a pet pot or something. Mm-hmm. And he opened that, so he pulled a vacuum on the finger of his left hand, and then with everybody watching the oscilloscope, he put the finger of his right hand into carbon tetrachloride.
Mm-hmm.
And my memory says 20 or 30 seconds later, up on the oscilloscope came the characteristic isotope peaks of carbon tetrachloride.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I tell the story to mass spectrometers, or to anybody that understands what's going on, of course it means the carbon tet gets into your bloodstream and back out the other finger and into the mass spectrometer in 25 seconds.
Mm-hmm. And then he tried...
Then he tried DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, and it came through so powerfully that it shut down the pumping system, which has an automatic shutoff. When the pressure gets above a certain place, it shuts down. And so DMSO came through him so fast, it shut down the pumping system. So try it sometime.
That's kind of, I don't think I want to do that experiment, but I'm sorry.
Well, you can try with ethanol.
Yeah, well, ethanol will be fine.
at least we can do it. Try it with the scotch.
So, yeah, there you go. So the what you're saying is the skin is pretty permeable. And
the bloodstream gets
blood
around pretty
it,
fast.
Right, yeah, it gets it and it delivers it to the other end of it. That's pretty scary, actually.
I've been telling that story for years, and I have yet to hear of anybody that's ever actually tried it themselves.
Well, I might try it with ethanol.
Try it with ethanol.
So I think we can move, I think we can move into academia now. You finally had...
Finally got to academia.
So now at this point, you really consider yourself being an analytical chemist or a physical chemist?
I went there as an analytical chemist, mm-hmm. Yes.
And so you're at Purdue. And you're working for this guy, Buck Rogers?
Yep.
And so your job...
He was... There they had divisions in chemistry, and I was a member of the analytical division, and Buck was its chair.
Okay, and so while other schools were divesting themselves of the analytical chemists, Purdue was decided they were not going to go that route.
Yeah, there were a few. I mean, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is famous for their analytical chemistry. Well, I said Charlie Riley was elected to the Academy in the 70s, mm-hmm. and they have, so the so that there are other places that, University of Illinois and Wisconsin always had good analytical departments.
Mm-hmm.
The state schools were quite well known for having good analytical chemistry, but almost all of the better chemistry departments, especially at the private schools, essentially got shut down in chemistry or something that was called that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are many people, I mean, there have been people that tell me that I'm not an analytical chemist, I'm really a organic chemist or a biochemist or a this or a that. Well, for me, it's easier to be an analytical chemist.
So when you went there, did you go there as an assistant professor or did you go with tenure?
I went as a professor.
So you went there as a tenure position?
I went there in 64. I was 41 years old.
Okay. So you'd establish yourself. So they gave you a tenure position.
And when people talk to me about academe, I tell them it's much easier to go as a professor than as an assistant professor. I recommend that.
Mm-hmm. I have a son who's having problems with that. So your tenure there, though, is not terribly long. You were there for what, about 4 years?
4 years.
Okay.
Right.
So, and that's in this business, that's just barely enough time to kind of get your shop up to speed.
Yeah, I was very lucky on grad students. I got a crop of 5 or 6 grad students the first year. They were great got everything going, and we got a new 21-110 double focusing instrument and RMU-6 single focusing, RMU-7 double focusing.
These were Japanese instruments, the RMU?
Hitachi. Yeah, these were Hitachi instruments. I was consulting for Hitachi. Well, actually, I first consulted for Varian, and so I had a Varian ICR. I got a Varian ICR. But I think Purdue actually bought me the 110. And of course, that made it much easier to get NIH grants.
Mm-hmm.
And I had grants seemed to come along okay. I had Army grants. Having my Army experience,
yes,
it made it easier for me to write grants that looked good in the Army.
So
you NSF grants.
You had to get into the grant acquisition business pretty quickly.
Yeah, but actually, industry and running, especially running in a lab and doing patents and things like that, and having had a secretary and having this kind of stuff sort of under control, the poor assistant professor who has to start out and has to do all of the trivial stuff himself,
mm-hmm.
too,
mm-hmm.
Has a very big extra burden.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that was a help. Oh, and I got to, Dow kept me on as a consultant, and so that was a big help. And as I say, I really did a lot of consulting, Varian, and then I started to consult for Hitachi, and that was very helpful, and went to Japan a number of times, and that's when they were planning a super high double focusing high resolution instrument that turned out to be the RMH2.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to Japan and seeing it and being so struck by it. And I said, well, to sell this, you got to demonstrate what its resolving power is.
Mm-hmm.
And your competition is demonstrating now 40,000 resolving power.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, how can... it won't do that. Well, I said, you got to have something to put in your ad.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was... It must have been midnight. This night when I was insisting they had to do this, and so I came up with something like xenon and dichloromethane had a doublet at 131 that was, to split it required 135,000 resolving power. Mm-hmm. And, oh, yes, we could do this. Of course, they set the slits on the jeweler's tool bench ahead of time to make sure they were just this side and everything else. Put it in there, they got this doublet. All the years that the RMH2 was advertised, they used this one doublet for their advertising that I came up with at midnight in Japan. Anyway, that's where scientific talent really comes in.
Right. Yeah, right. Yes. So that they wanted to get into the accurate mass, the high resolving power instruments.
They wanted to beat out CEC
and AEI or Kratos or whatever they were at the time. I don't know, they keep changing. So there was a pretty big market at that time for high resolving power instruments.
And they were selling a lot of these RMU7s, the small one. It didn't have the resolving power.
What kind of resolving power did that have with the 7?
10,000, 15,000. We had RMU7 there, and we got an RMU7 when I came to Cornell, and it seemed like we, on a good day with wind behind our backs, we could get 20,000.
Were these Japanese instruments reverse or forward geometry?
They were all forward geometry. Can I tell more stories?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's what we're here for.
Well, the reverse geometry came out and was fascinating and everything.
Who did that? Who was the first to do the reverse?
The guys at AEI, Bordolier and Sedgwick.
Oh, really?
I forgot which ones. Maybe Mickey Barber had something to do with it, too. I forgot. But it was like in 70 or one of the meetings in 70. Anyway, I came back here and we talked about this, and I've always had fun arguing with my students. That's what I love to do, and I usually lose the arguments. But anyway, two students, Paul Bente, B-E-N-T-E, and he went to DuPont and worked on DuPont mass spectrometer first, and Tim Wachs, W-A-C-H. They came in one day and said, well, we figured out how to reverse the geometry on the RMU7. And I was very skeptical that these two grad students could do this. And, oh, yes. We're doing it for this value project. Well, nobody's using the instrument this week. This weekend, we've looked at the sign-up sheet. He said, if we can't do it this weekend, Monday morning we'll put it back in shape and they can use it. Well, okay, generous me. Well, I came in Monday morning and they were sweating and it didn't work. Well, we got everything right. It's got to work. And, well, you know, I said, well, yeah, you know, I didn't say I told you. I walked in my office. An hour later, they come running in, yelling, screaming. They had the thing going. Well, what was wrong? We forgot to reverse the magnetic field. And so we used the reverse geometry. For some years, it was our primary MS instrument. We did all our, we really did from 68 to 78, 90% of the papers on MSMS for structure were ours, and most of them are on that instrument.
So why, who was the first person then to do the reverse geometry, to come up with the reverse geometry instrument?
I think it was the guys at AEI.
And
there's a paper at one of the ASMS meetings along that time, that at least I think it's the first one, and I've forgotten what their actual publication was, but that's when I learned of it, and we went ahead and used it. Because the first MSMS, the first collisional activation to do structures that we did in 67 was on the time of flight.
Mm-hmm. So you did that in 67, and that was with retarding potential?
That was a retarding potential in the flight path. Right.
Oh, okay.
And we didn't do that. That wasn't original with us.
Mm-hmm.
The retarding potential.
That was.
The boys at the Lincoln Lab outside of Boston did some very nice. In fact, what were their names? Anyway, they were tremendously helpful to us.
Was that, Bendix had these type of flight symposia in Cincinnati. I guess, did you go to any of those meetings at the Cincinnati? They had the...
Yeah, I think I went to one.
They were kind of fun because it was a small group and they all had the same instrument and everybody had the same problems.
I wasn't more than one. In fact, I remember one in Detroit, but I'm not sure I remember any in Cincinnati.
Okay. Yeah, well, these were late years later. I was probably been in the late 60s, early 70s.
I probably did.
Yeah. So,
Don, what was it, Don?
There was Don Damas.
Don Damas, yeah.
Yeah. With those guys. So you were only at Purdue for 4 years. It seemed like kind of a short period of time. You came up here to Cornell.
Yeah, we had a time of flight there. We had all sorts of instruments, and I got this Babu Venkataraghavan came, Rengachari Venkataraghavan.
So we got to do some spelling here for me. Or you want to just show
me? Get the book back for you. I can spell it, but it's easier to.
So he had a nickname by Babu?
Babu. B-A-B-U.
So he was with you at Purdue?
He came in 65, and he was with me until 1977, 12 years.
So he went up here, came up here to?
Cornell also.
To Cornell.
He was here 65 to 77, he'd gotten his PhD in India with Ram Rao, C-N-R, his initials are C-N-R, Rao, R-A-O, but everybody calls him Ram, R-E-M. And he ended up to be the presidential science advisor to the president of India, and he's a foreign member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and so forth. And of course, I've known him almost ever since I got Babu, because Babu had done a postdoctorate with Norman Jones, a very famous infrareder in Ottawa at the National Research Council, and he had done computerization of infrared spectra with Norman Jones, and so he worked on the computerization of things for us, and. He was absolutely terrific, and we PDP-8, and we got there. Then we got a Sigma 5 that they kept at Purdue. Then we got PDP-11s here, and on and until 1177. But he interfaced. The first thing we interfaced there was a Grant densitometer read photoplanes. He did it. But Klaus Beeman had done this kind of thing also. The Grant densitometer was fancier, and Babu's programs spit out our data much faster than previous, but certainly I don't want to take anything away from Klaus. He really pioneered all of that. But then Babu really pioneered getting away from the photoplates and getting the data out directly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's the first one to do that. The tragic part of that was that I was consulting for Hitachi, and Perkin Elmer sold Hitachi instruments in the United States, had an exclusive license.
Mm-hmm.
And I told my Perkin Elmer friends, well, come see it. They came and saw that the RMU7 and bingity bing, out comes the high resolution elemental composition data out of the other end in real time
mm-hmm.
with this PDP-8. What did Perkin-Elmer do without any contract with me or anything? They bought 25 PDPAs, took Babu software, and started selling this.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one they sold it to was our good friends at the EPA lab in Georgia.
Yeah, I know the name. I can't think of it either.
Now I'll be in trouble. Well, he'll forgive me. But of course, by the time they implemented, God, there it didn't work. Well, the higher ups at Perkin-Elmer said that was my fault. My fault?
What did you do?
I don't have a contract with you. You're not sending me any royalties. And I said, I want it to work. Heavens, of course I want it to work. And so we sent Babu down, and Babu got it going. And I said, but for heaven's sake, send your own software engineers down there
yes.
so you learn how to do this
yes.
so Babu doesn't have to do the next one. The guy never showed up. And the next time, and well, they finally bailed out, had to bail out of the business, and they lost enough money, and they decided, at the same time, they brought out their own tiny double focusing instrument
mm-hmm.
designed by Al Neer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for GCMS,
mm-hmm.
but it was double focusing.
Mm-hmm.
It was slow as hell for scanning, had a terrible pumping system
mm-hmm.
on it. Your background was horrible, and it was a total disaster. And besides, it was the same time that the computerized quantum modes
yeah.
were coming out. And so they had to scan spectra anyway. And so the president of Perkin-Elmer, Horace McDonald, I still remember Horace McDonald.
Horace
H-O-R-A-C-E McDonald.
Donald is a
McDonald. Oh, you've known McDonald's, yes.
Well, that's a different spelling.
That's right.
Bill McFadden said that's supposed to be McDonnell.
McDonnell.
Yeah.
Hadn't heard that one.
Yeah. So Horace McDonald was the president of Perkin-Elmer.
Anyway, he was the president of Perkin-Elmer, and thanks. Well, my side of the story is it's not my fault, and they never paid me a nickel or promised to pay me a nickel. Anyway, about that time, I'm moving to Ithaca, and of course, Purdue kept all my stuff, including my new $2 million NIH facility. And I had gotten a promise when I told my friends in Hitachi, they said, oh, Fred, we'll give you another RHD, no problem. And in fact, I said, well, where is it? We called my friends at Perkin-Elmer, the lower downwards. They said, it's in a warehouse now in New Jersey, but Horace McDonald has stopped the shipment to Cornell. So I went down. I spent the better part of the day talking only to Horace McDonald, whoever he had come in, and about, you can't do this to me, and yes, I can. It wasn't my fault. Well, somebody's got to pay for this, and so forth. And at the end, we worked out something where Cornell, Carl Sagan, how he ever forgives me, was here, of course. You remember Carl Sagan?
Yeah.
Well, he had a program going in which he needed a GC mass spec.
Mm-hmm.
And so Carl, that's ahead of the story, sorry. But we needed a GC mass spec in the service line. And so I got Cornell to buy one of their GC mass specs that he couldn't sell.
Mm-hmm.
And he then shipped the free $150,000 instrument that Hitachi had given me up here, and every time I meet somebody from Perkin-Elmer years later, and I'd say, "Well, how's my friend Horace McDonald?" Oh, he talks about you. I said, well, maybe I better not hear what he said.
So they were a little bit naive, I think, to
oh, they were totally
to think that they could just take a computer and a box of software and turn it into a data
That's
system.
Exactly right. You put your finger on it entirely.
But that was your fault, not their fault.
That was my fault. And of course, I couldn't do it either, but this Bob who can do it.
Yeah.
And he had programmed it in machine language, and he Bob who could do all these things. And we did probability-based batch. We first did self-training and interpretive retrieval systems, and he was terrific for that. And then we did the probability-based matching, which is used on more laboratories than any other matching system in the world. And last count, 25,000, whatever.
So there's a couple of things I want to talk about before we get too far afield here. One of them is it seems like a rather cursory stay at Purdue before you came to Cornell. What's going on there?
Purdue was great. The first person I should mention is John Amy and Bill Badinger. Amy, A-M-Y. And his right-hand man was Bill Badinger, B-A-I-T-I-N-G-E-R. You'll see their names on some of my papers at that time. And John ran a instrument lab that was... John had a PhD. Entirely created instrument lab. And so for doing things in the mass spec, with the mass spectrometer and revising it or fixing it or making it do better, he was tremendous. And he was tremendous also in training my students so that they were hands-on mass spectrometers. And he was very interested in this project and very enthusiastic about it and just gave us tremendous help.
And this project, what is that?
The project of getting me a whole new research program going.
Okay.
When I was running this lab for 8 years, for the first 6 years at Dow, I had a bunch of projects like improving the instrument, getting new instruments, putting in gas chromatography, finding correlations of spectra. And then when for the 8 years I was there, all I could do was correlate spectra, because when we put in an instrument with Roland, we used this to help the laboratory, but we used it for some reference spectra for our spectral correlations, but I didn't really get into many new things along that line. But anyway, we got into all sorts of new things at Purdue in terms of all of the stuff with Babu and the computers was competitive. We got an ICR.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly anybody else had an ICR.
Mm-hmm.
We had Mike Gross was my first ICR man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you know about that.
Mm-hmm.
We had a time of flight, and we did collisional activation on the time of flight. We had the first collisional activation for determining structures of ions.
But now this is up at Cornell.
This is all at Purdue.
Purdue. Was Gross at Purdue? No. I think Gross came up here. Mike Gross.
No, he was at Purdue.
He was at Purdue, okay.
He went from Purdue to Nebraska.
Okay.
He went from Purdue to Nebraska. No, we did the first MS for structure determination with metastable ions in 1965 there.
Mm-hmm.
People don't know about it, and we did the first collisional activation for MS there in 1967, and the collisional activation, or CID as they like to call it, that my good friend at work, well, today is not my day.
I know what you're talking about.
Peter Derrick, Alan McCall.
Mm-hmm.
Alan,
last name
is that right? Alan? Is that right? No, that's not.
McCollum?
No, that's not the one. Just the this is terrible. This is terrible.
No, it happened to me a lot, Fred, so don't worry about it.
This is terrible. Fred, this is... some things that you sort of have to get your head back on your shoulders. If I say the wrong name, Keith Jennings.
Jennings, yes.
Keith Jennings, sorry about that.
No problem.
Anyway, Keith did this beautiful collisional activation work in which he took benzene ions and bashed them in an MS instrument and came up with fragment ions that were very instructive about the benzene ion, but of course you got the same fragment ions if you used NaC6H6 isomer.
Mm-hmm.
And we're the ones that I think our publication I think came several months after his, but we took isomers that are common and differentiated the isomers,
mm-hmm,
by their collisional activation spectrum. That,
tandem MS?
You take ethyl alcohol and knock out a hydrogen, and you have the CH3CH. Double bond OH plus ion, and if you did the same thing to dimethyl ether that has lost a hydrogen, you'd have CH3OCH2. Well, of course, they're identical composition, but if under collisional activation, they fall apart,
mm-hmm,
to give highly characteristic spectra, and that's what we did. And we did that from this time at Purdue. Well, actually, the first metastable we worked on was 65. And before anybody did much of anything on it, it was the late 70s. We were a voice crying in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Keith Jennings used it for fundamental things, but never for separating isomers. And, of course, that's the basis of our MSMS. We have a 1970 publication in which we did this for peptides.
Mm.
We put a mixture of peptides in, isolated the molecular ion of the peptide in the first mass separation,
mm-hmm,
and broke it up and sequenced it in the second.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's proteomics.
Yes, that's
proteomics.
That's the beginning.
And that was 1970, and in the thing we gave full credit to Klaus Beeman for showing you could do the sequencing part, but we put the two things together.
So, the time at Purdue was pretty productive.
I started a whole new research program.
You had a big grant from NIH to set up a research facility, a research resource.
Right.
So, I still haven't gotten to the reason why you packed up and went to Cornell. I mean, you know, you're like at the beginning, at this threshold of a great career here in Purdue, which is, you know, respectable
institution. Yeah, why did I come?
And so all of a sudden you back everything up and come up here.
Purdue was a great place. I kid you not, Purdue was a great place.
But I mean, it seems a little weird that you would decide to just, you know, head east all of a sudden and come up to, I mean, Cornell's a great place too, but I mean, it just seems like a sudden wrench in the, you know, just taking a left turn right when you're about ready to get off the ground.
Well, Cornell does attract better graduates. Cornell's ranking isn't number one, but it's
better than Purdue.
Quite a lot higher than Purdue. Purdue people were really nice, and of course the other thing is Cornell's my alma mater, and I've kept close track of Cornell over the years, and it always has this aura of being a friendly place.
Now, did you?
And it is totally a friendly department. And when we have something important to decide, like who's going to get tenure, we meet and we meet and we meet. If we can't decide, we just have another meeting. And then we can't decide, we have another meeting. Find we're exhausted enough, we have a unanimous decision, and then we all got to stick with it. If we made the if the person gets a Nobel Prize, we're all brilliant. If the person is turns out to run off with the dean's wife, well, then we're all at fault.
Yeah. So I mean, part of it, well, I mean, Cornell.
I love Cornell.
Okay, well, but Cornell came to you. They come to you when you were at Purdue and say, "Hey, dude, why don't you come up here?"
No.
Okay.
It was out of the blue. I still like close ties with Cornell, but.
So it's just, I mean, in the final analysis, it was a place you'd rather spend the rest of your career.
And
even though, I mean, it was a bit of a dislocation because you had to move. Well, the grant did.
Turned out to be a huge dislocation.
Yeah.
I had arranged with NIH to transfer all of that to Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
And then Purdue decided otherwise,
mm-hmm.
or Purdue got their senator, actually, to decide otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's fine. That's fine. It turned out that Hitachi gave me a mass spectrometer to replace the one that John Bynum got. Turned out that John Bynum found that his had a second order mistake in the calculations,
mm-hmm.
Which of course only John would. There's where it was really hard on Hitachi because Fred would have never found it. Error in the second order term.
Yeah.
John's a physicist. He would find it.
Yeah.
So, and certainly it never affected my relationship with John.
Yeah.
In fact, I was pleased that they got the thing that if I couldn't have it, well, it's great that John got it.
How did Bynum, I mean, he's pretty well established in the UK. How was he convinced to go to Purdue to kind of like pick up the ball, you know, when you left Purdue?
Well,
did he come immediately after you left, or?
Oh, it took him a year, I think.
Okay.
But it was pretty fast, considering.
Yeah.
And, he came from, he still was with ICI when he came, or had he? I think he was still with ICI.
He's been like 69.
He went in 69.
Yeah.
He went in 69.
Okay.
Well, you can check.
Yeah.
But he had connections with the University of Manchester and things like that, but I think he was still on the payroll and very well situated at ICI,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But, of course, in Britain, being a professor that means is much more stature than being a professor here. With all due respect, you saw where we ate lunch.
Yeah, yeah, well.
We professors where we got to eat lunch.
Yeah.
Well, you know about that, professors in the United States. But I'm sure his reasons for going, when I talked to him, I talked to him about it before he made the switch, and he had the same reasons I did for going from industry to academia.
Mm-hmm.
He's a little older than I am,
mm-hmm.
but of course he wasn't there long before he recruited Graham,
mm-hmm.
and I was delighted that John went there. It did not affect our relationship whatsoever, and he certainly made things hot there and did things to fix the second order aberration correction, edge correct that,
So let's see, Caprioli was...
Caprioli went there?
Well, he spent some time with... Was it Bynum? When he spent time with you at Purdue or with John Bynum or Graham? When did Caprioli come through Purdue?
Oh, I think Graham that Bynum got there in 69. He got Graham there because, I think he had a... Part of his deal was that he wasn't even there full time, that maybe he was already at Swansea.
Oh, okay.
And that he was part, still kept his appointment at Swansea. So maybe he had already gone to Swansea, but not very long before that. Because I remember talking to him about going to Academe, and we both did in the 60s. Anyway, and he got Graham to come, and Caprioli. I think Caprioli was a year or two after Graham, but you can, if you want to know, we can look it up in the Director of Graduate Research.
So you basically kind of got things started at Purdue, and then Cornell just was too good an opportunity to pass up.
Yeah, but things really started up in a hurry there. I suppose another thing you could look at is that I had saving up ideas that I couldn't work on all the time I was an administrator now. Part of what triggered it is they offered me a job running all the analytical at Dow, and the main analytical lab was 250 people or something like that, and salary was much greater, and the honor was terrific, but we'd have to move back to Midland, and I'd have no time for personal research, and so that sort of said, well, what do you want to do?
So basically, if you were going to stay in an industrial environment, you would have to forsake research and go up the management tree.
Oh, sure.
And so you didn't want to really bail out of the research side of things.
And there are other people that are better managers than I am. There are. I'm volatile. I'm all excited.
Okay, well, let's see. It's 4:30. You want to maybe take a break or...
I would suggest that any time you want to quit, you go back to the hotel and we pick you up at 6 or 6:30 and go to dinner.
Okay. I'd like to come back in the morning and spend maybe an hour or two just going over a few things. We've kind of gotten up to an area where there's a reasonable amount of information at from the Cornell video interview and from Karsten Reinhardt's thing. So I don't think we need to go over a lot of that, but I did want to go over some names of people. Also maybe do a little bit of a discussion of Reinhardt's interpretation of how things,
that'd be interesting.
Because I assume you've read the book.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
I thought he understood the science much better than I expected he could. I must admit, I was...
Okay, well, I think we've kind of worn ourselves out for the day. Why don't we call it a halt to the proceedings at this point, and then we can stop by in the morning.
Leave this here if you want to.